Today is Tuesday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, what does President Trump need to make a meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un happen?
In a way, any agreement he comes up with has to be better than the Iran nuclear deal.
The Trump administration has demanded sweeping changes in Iran. An Australian archbishop was found guilty of concealing child sex abuse by a priest. And summer movies are here. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump welcomed South Korean leader Moon Jae-in to the White House on Tuesday. President Trump said that there was a substantial chance his summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would not take place as planned on June 12th amid concerns Mr. Kim is not committed to denuclearization. Trump raised doubts about the session planned in Singapore in talks with South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who came to Washington to urge Mr. Trump not to let a rare opportunity with the reclusive North Korean leader get away. Bruce Klinger is a senior research fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. I spoke with him by phone this morning and started off our conversation by asking him, what does President Trump hope to get out of today's two-hour meeting with President Moon that he didn't get out of Sunday's reported 20-minute phone call?
Well, the original intent of this summit was to coordinate policy between the two allies prior to President Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore on June 12th. But last week, North Korea released three statements that were critical of the U.S. administration as well as the South Korean administration, and also really removed the fig leaf of what its conditions for denuclearization would be, which is different from, I think, what the perception the White House had. So today's meeting might be a bit more tense than originally intended because the president may feel that he was misled from the South Korean delegation as to sort of how easily that we'd be able to achieve North Korean denuclearization.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has really made it a point of his presidency to really focus on engagement with North Korea since taking office. What does he need from the meeting with the president of the United States this afternoon?
Well, he's hoping to keep the U.S.-North Korea summit on track, diffuse any tension between himself and President Trump. And South Korea has announced it wants to serve as a mediator role between North Korea and the U.S. Now, that raises some questions as to, you know, on the one hand, North Korea is our common enemy, which is threatening not only South Korea, but all of our forces there and increasingly the American homeland. And the U.S. is obviously an ally. So for South Korea to say it wants to mediate between the two raises the risk that, you know, it'll be perceived as advocating for North Korea, which is our common enemy. South Korean officials, you know, sort of indicate they want to counsel the U.S. to lower the bar, perhaps, for what it would accept in a deal.
What ultimately does the President of the United States need in terms of assurances for that summit to take place?
The three statements from North Korea last week really cast a heavy, dark shadow over the summit. Everything had seemed to be moving in a positive direction, even though we're skeptical North Korea will actually give up its nuclear weapons or do so with conditions that we might accept. You know, to have the criticism of specifically John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, as well as the Trump administration itself and the South Korean administration, and then more clearly disagree with what the U.S. Denuclearization goals were, you know, really sort of cast doubt on how successful the summit may be. President Trump is going to be looking for North Korea to agree to a rapid implementation of what's called CVID, Comprehensive Verifiable Irreversible Dismantlement of the North Korean Nuclear Program.
Now, anything short of that, could President Trump call a summit successful?
He may very well. I mean, if you look at his book, The Art of the Deal, he has a section in there on what he calls truthful hyperbole. Sort of the idea of everyone wants to believe they bought the best, the biggest, so why not let them think that? So we've seen other occasions where he's, you know, stretched the description of something. So he may get something that's less than what the U.S. would like to get, but declare it as the best and the brightest in history. You know, in a way, he set a very high bar for success by not only criticizing but pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal and then criticizing all previous agreements with North Korea. in a way, any agreement he comes up with has to be better than the Iran nuclear deal, the 8 previous agreements with North Korea, the 10 existing UN resolutions on North Korea, and verifications equal to or greater than that we had in the arms control treaties with the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact.
Bruce Klinger is a senior research fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. He joined me by phone. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
The World Health Organization says 33 people, mostly frontline healthcare workers, were vaccinated against Ebola on Monday in Mbandaka. It's a city of more than 1 million people. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
More than 7,500 doses of the Ebola vaccine have been shipped to the Democratic Republic of Congo. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich tells VOA he expects the campaign to accelerate and ultimately reach thousands of people. Jazarevich says a lot of work has to be done before this complex operation can hit its stride. For example, he says transporting the vaccines and storing them in freezers in affected areas is a major challenge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here are some other top stories from around the globe. China said Tuesday it will cut tariffs on most imported cars from 25% to 15% beginning July 1st. The United States imposed economic sanctions Monday on Venezuela for what it said was the country's fraudulent re-election of President Nicolas Maduro to a second six-year term. A German court on Tuesday rejected a request from prosecutors to take former Catalan leader Carlos Puigdemont back into custody. For additional stories and in-depth coverage, visit our website or download our mobile app to take the stories with you. This is VOA.
News and notes. This is Living Better.
He survived the Vietnam War, but decades later, Air Force veteran James Wellman lost his right hand in a work accident.
Your expectations are, well, I can't do anything now, and that's not the case. You know, I thought there was a lot of things I wouldn't be able to do, and then you start getting along with it.
Now at age 72, he has a new hand, thanks to the Veterans Administration and the Touch Bionics Company.
The list of things you didn't think you could do gets shorter, you know, and then pretty soon you throw it out. You know, you can do what you want, it's just that I do things differently.
Prosthetist Karen Pung has worked with Wellman since he first started using the iLimb Bionic Hand.
I don't know how to explain it, it's a really good feeling, it makes you get up in the morning to be excited to see people and see them be improved.
The iLimb has 5 independently moving digits and variable grip strength. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
VOA's International Edition continues. The Trump administration has demanded sweeping changes in Iran and warned Monday of unprecedented financial pressure on the Iranian regime. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said even with the 2015 International Nuclear Agreement, Iran continues to develop ballistic and cruise missiles, fuels proxy wars across the Middle East, backs militant groups like Hezbollah, and continues to sponsor and harbor terrorists. Aside from what Pompeo called the strongest sanctions in history, the United States will seek to deter Iranian aggression. Laying out a 12-point list of demands, he called for a new agreement with Tehran that ensures it never acquires nuclear weapons, releases foreigners jailed unjustly, ends missile proliferation, and halts regional adventurism.
In exchange for major changes in Iran, the United States is prepared to take actions which will benefit the Iranian people. These areas of action include a number of things. First, once this is achieved, we're prepared to end the principal components of every one of our sanctions against the regime. We're happy at that point to reestablish full diplomatic and commercial relationships with Iran. And we're prepared to admit Iran to have advanced technology. If Iran makes this fundamental strategic shift, we too are prepared to support the modernization, reintegration of the Iranian economy into the international economic system. But relief from our efforts will come only when we see tangible, demonstrated, and sustained shifts in Tehran's policies.
Behnam Bin Taliblu is a research fellow at the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that Pompeo's speech contained elements of both old and new Iran policy.
New because it's the first time an administration really put all of our economic leverage on the table like that. But it was also old because the 12 list of items that the secretary stated that he would like to see substantial change on or improvement on from the Islamic Republic, those are all old, outstanding items. Those are items that have kept Iran as a pariah state and made it live basically on the fringes of the international community because of its penchant for supporting terrorism, obsession with uranium enrichment, desire to proliferate, produce, procure, and test ballistic missiles, and deployment of the Quds Force throughout the Middle East, multiple conflict zones. So all of those issues are not new. But being kind of creatively put together and not isolating Iran's threats into nuclear and all else and dealing with the entire issue, I think, is what is new. So I think in terms of the framing of the problem, it was profoundly new, useful, and bold. I would say that this is big for big by Washington.
Iran responded, among other things, saying that what Washington is demanding is regime change. Does he have a point?
Not necessarily, because Iranian officials tend to engage in hyperbole when talking about domestic conditions, their military capabilities, and, of course, U.S. policy towards Iran. But it is worth noting that Secretary Pompeo did actually come out very strongly in support of the Iranian people. Admittedly, none of the 12 measures of change he mentioned were about Iranian domestic behavior. They were all about the regime's foreign and security policy abroad. But there was a substantial amount of space in the text given to supporting the Iranian people, speaking about their plight, and saying how Iranians simply deserve better. And if one combines that, one could begin to see a rollback of Iran in the region and hopefully some kind of political change within the country. But I think the focus, again, is on the external.
Does this further aggravate tensions between the U.S. and its European allies who are sticking with the 2015 Iran nuclear deal?
Just as the Europeans are seeking to stick with the JCPOA, Washington is seeking to stick to its guns, basically saying that sanctions will be at the forefront of an attempt to get Iran to change from these 12 measures of bad behavior. Europe, please join us. The secretary was curt but firm into how he phrased Europe's concerns.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani dismissed the speech, asking Pompeo, "Who are you to decide for Iran and the world?" European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini said the address did not demonstrate how walking away from the 2015 agreement will make the region safer from the threat of nuclear proliferation or makes it easier to influence Iranian conduct. An Australian archbishop was found guilty on Tuesday of concealing child sex abuse by a priest, which Australian media said made him the most senior Catholic in the world to be convicted on such a charge. The AP's Mike Gracia has the details.
Australian Archbishop Philip Wilson has become the most senior Roman Catholic cleric in the world to be convicted of covering up child sex abuse. Magistrate Robert Stone handed down the guilty verdict. The 67-year-old Wilson had pleaded not guilty to knowing of the crimes of a pedophile priest in the 1970s. In court last month, Wilson denied under oath that two former altar boys told him they had been sexually abused by a priest. Wilson, who's been diagnosed with early stages of Alzheimer's disease, faces a potential 2-year prison sentence. I'm Mike Rossia.
Philip Wilson is the Archbishop of Adelaide and a former president of the Catholic Church's top body in Australia. The sentencing is expected to take place in June. Last year, Australia completed a 5-year government-appointed inquiry into child sex abuse in churches and other institutions amid allegations worldwide that churches had protected pedophile priests by moving them from parish to parish. The inquiry heard that 7% of Catholic priests working in Australia between 1950 and 2010 had been accused of child sex crimes, and that nearly 1,100 people had filed child sexual assault claims against the Anglican Church over 35 years. This is VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
Warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama have entered into a multi-year agreement to produce films and series with Netflix. That's the American-based internet entertainment service that streams movies, shows, and original programming across the globe. The AP's Jackie Quinn has more.
The former president and first lady will produce a diverse mix of content, some scripted, some not, and documentaries and features. An insider says they'll participate in some of the programming, but not all, and the aim is to keep it nonpartisan. Former President Obama says they hope to cultivate and curate the talented, inspiring voices that can promote great empathy and understanding. No material is expected until at least 2019 from the new Obama production company, Higher Ground. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Ultimately, the projects will be available to the 125 million member Netflix households in 190 countries. May 26th to 28th marks Memorial Day weekend in the United States. It takes place on the last Monday during the month of May. It honors those men and women who died while serving in the armed forces throughout the years. The holiday originated in the years following the American Civil War and was known as Decoration Day. It became an official federal holiday in 1971. The holiday also signals the unofficial start of summer, when schools let out and children start to enjoy some time off from academics. It also means Hollywood kicks off its summertime blockbuster season. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Las Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard about two films that aim to cash in.
Chewbacca's back. We've got Memorial Day weekend kicking off the holiday movie season, Jeff, and Star Wars is making a comeback of sorts.
Why did you mention Chewbacca? Are you a fan of Chewbacca?
Well, who isn't?
You know, I was never a fan of Chewbacca growing up, believe it or not, and it's not because of the character. It's because when I was a little boy, I had a profound fear of Bigfoot.
Okay.
So every time I saw the commercial as a little boy when the original Star Wars came out, I thought that was Bigfoot piloting the Millennium Falcon. So, but yes, we do have a new Star Wars film right in time for Memorial Day weekend, and it's an origin story, meaning it's the origin of Han Solo.
Wow.
So
that's kind of cool.
Find out. It is. Isn't that cool?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you follow the trade papers, you know, this movie has been plagued with production problems. The original directors were fired. They brought in Ron Howard to kind of do some pickups and to kind of fix it. They had the Star Wars Empire Strikes Back writers, you know, the father, Lawrence Kasdan, and his son writing the screenplay. So Disney has a lot riding on this because there's been so much production trouble. But what's really cool about this movie, fresh out of the screening, is that it's a space western. And what I mean by that is that it parallels and parodies just about everything that's in a classic western. You have a train heist, a space train heist. You have a bank vault that they have to rob. You have poker games. So I'm sitting there watching this origin story of Han Solo and how he met Chewbacca, how he met Lando Calrissian, some of the famous things in the first Star Wars films with like the Kessel Run. So everything that we've heard, all these little trivia things that didn't really make any sense growing up, now they've really had time to flesh out how these facts and how these legends have begun.
Is it revenge? Money.
You know, the first hour of the movie comes in at 2 hours and 15 minutes. The first hour is pretty slow. It really has a hard time getting going. But once Star Wars, a solo story, starts to really soar, it's exciting. One of my all-time favorite actors is Woody Harrelson. He plays one of the smugglers. And it's just an amazing adventure to find out your favorite Star Wars characters, how they met, and how they go on this incredible origin adventure. So Disney's got it right by doing these original stories of our favorite characters from Star Wars.
That sounds very cool and like a good way to start off the holiday weekend and the summer movie season. And then we've got Deadpool. I think this is a comedy. It certainly looks like it has to be with someone surviving a near-fatal cow attack.
You know, it's funny. You read the synopsis online, and that's a joke on Ryan Reynolds, who plays Deadpool, who's also one of the producers and forces behind the making of the film. The synopsis you find online of what Deadpool 2 is about is a total fabrication. None of that is true, because it reflects what the movie's all about, where the joke is on you, the joke is on the audience, the joke is on Deadpool.
Hit it! There's this kid. He's in trouble.
Move or die.
Pump the hate brakes, Thanos.
Basically, what you have, the sequel to the first film, is Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool, who's a Marvel outcast superhero who can regenerate, so he can never die. But he's got a smart mouth. He's got no regard for authority. He does what he wants to do. And this time around, he's got to battle a cyborg from the future named Cable, played by Josh Brolin. He comes back in time to save his family and run into Deadpool, who they just have these massive fights throughout the entire film. And not only that, Deadpool can't get into X-Men, so he creates his own X-Men called the X-Force, which are just ragtag group of mutants that really don't contribute much to the world of superheroes, let's put it that way. Mm. The movie's raunchy, it's rated R, it breaks that fourth wall, you know, so he talks to the audience. People were just eating it up, I'm telling you, Laurie. They just went crazy for this movie. And you know what? I did too. It's not as good as the original, but it's very, very close. But just remember, it's for adults only. Don't bring the kids. But it's also got great original action, and it's got some really funny humor.
Deadpool opened last weekend, and according to 20th Century Fox, the film took home an estimated $125 million. That dethroned Disney's Avengers Infinity War for the top spot at the box office, but the Marvel superhero film has already gone on to make nearly $2 billion worldwide. Both films, by the way, star Josh Brolin. And that is going to do it for me today. I'd like to thank Steve Karish for directing today's show and Linus Renkis for engineering the broadcast. But most importantly, I'd like to thank you for listening. If you haven't yet, be sure to follow The Voice of America on social media. You know, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There you'll find pictures, stories, videos, and more. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have an absolutely fantastic day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, has designated Venezuelan national Diosdado Cabello Rondon, pursuant to Executive Order 13692, for being a current or former official of the government of Venezuela. OFAC also designated three other individuals, José David Cabello Rondon, Cabello's brother, and Marlene Josefina Contreras Hernandez, Cabello's wife, were designated for being a current or former official of the government of Venezuela. Rafael Alfredo Saria Diaz, Cabello's frontman, was designated for acting for or on behalf of Cabello. In addition, OFAC blocked three companies that are owned or controlled by Saria in Florida: SAI Advisors Incorporated, Noor Plantation Investments LLC, and 11420 Corporation. OFAC further blocked 14 properties in Florida and New York, owned by Saria directly or through his companies. The written statement by OFAC noted that U.S. sanctions need not be permanent. They are intended to change behavior. It went on to say that sanctions could be lifted for persons that take concrete and meaningful actions to restore democratic order, refuse to take part in human rights abuses, and speak out against abuses committed by the government and combat corruption in Venezuela. The latest designations reflect the commitment of the United States to use every available diplomatic and economic tool to hold accountable corrupt officials and support the Venezuelan people's efforts to restore their democracy. The United States will continue to take appropriate action, including designating persons for sanctions, to respond to the situation in Venezuela as it develops. The Venezuelan people suffer under corrupt politicians who tighten their grip on power while lining their own pockets, said Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. We are imposing costs on figures like Diosdado Cabello, who exploit their official positions to engage in narcotics trafficking, money laundering, embezzlement of state funds, and other corrupt activities. This administration, declared Secretary Mnuchin, is committed to holding those accountable who violate the trust of the Venezuelan people, and we will continue to block attempts to abuse the U.S. financial system.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.